Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Caroline Roberts.
And welcome back, Caroline. It's good to have you back on Your Health.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
You know, on our show today, we're talking with Dr. James Bolton, assistant professor at the University of Manitoba, Department of Psychiatry, about forgotten grievers, children who lose a brother or sister, something that seems like it's really common and I don't think we've ever really talked about. First, though, we got some research that matters, and this first one is one that just kind of makes you feel good, a feel-good research that matters. We don't do a whole lot of those.
So we are talking about how family dogs could actually be very beneficial in their owners, their children that they live with that have physical disabilities.
Yeah, and this was some research that's really interesting. It was based on a study of one 10-year-old boy with cerebral palsy and their family dog. I wish they had gotten their family dog's name, a Pomeranian, a little small dog, and this dog being trained and the patient to help increase physical activity, for which children with cerebral palsy have less physical activity than their counterparts. And so the premise was, obviously, this dog, this companionship dog, that both of them getting trained and doing physical things could improve physical activity and all kinds of other quality of life measures.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It actually wasn't a very intense intervention. It was 8 weeks, and what it included was about a 60-minute session per week that focused on activities such as brushing the dog with both hands, playing fetch with both hands, balancing on a wobble board, and marching on a balancing disc.
All of things which I think sound kind of fun, and obviously this dog had some good abilities. I'm thinking about, you know, my old German Shepherd Bruno growing up. Not only would I don't think he would have been able to do this, it was a little scariness. Bruno tended to bite people, so I don't think this is for all dogs. And you have some dogs that you said.
Yeah, two dachshunds. And
they could do it?
Absolutely not.
They're lovable.
And very lovable and lick you to death kind of dogs. But I don't think they have taught my 15-month-old much of anything at all.
So clearly we need a broader range of animals here. And we know that there's significant training and support here. But I think it's great because they were really showing increasing motor skills, increasing quality of life, increased human-animal interactions. Everyone had homework and, sedentary behavior decreased. I just think this is really great, that bond that can form between an animal and their owner, in this case, people with disabilities. I think it's great.
I agree. I think it's a very low-risk intervention.
In the right circumstances.
Yeah, unless it's Bruno, right?
Yeah, Bruno or your dachshunds.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about our very next research that matters. And this is for people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Does taking your medicines reduce car crashes?
So interestingly enough, adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder had a substantially less risk of having car crashes when they were receiving an ADHD medicine. They found that male ADHD patients had a 38% lower risk of a motor vehicle crash, and that female ADHD patients had a 42% lower risk of a motor vehicle crash.
That's impressive.
Yes, I agree.
It seems to affect the things that sometimes are linked to higher car crashes: inattention, hyperactivity, impulsivity. And I know this was in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, subspecialty journal, psychiatry. And in an editorial, they talked about, you know, driving is such a complex executive order function, and there's so many different things that can be errors and problems, and that the medications actually may reduce it, which I thought, this is really fascinating. I wonder if, like, insurance companies, auto insurance companies, would actually give reductions in premiums to those who have the condition who documented taking medications. That seems like it would create a win-win-win.
That's a great question. When I thought, the sentence that stuck out to me most about ADHD medicines in this article was that they are not a cure, but more like eyeglasses that help improve vision. So kind of take a person's baseline being, and just make it a little bit easier.
I like that analogy.
Yeah.
And I drive with my eyeglasses.
Yeah.
Could you imagine me? You don't want me on the road without my eyeglasses.
I don't think so.
I'm going to take them off and I'm going to say, what color is that light? And you say, what color is that light? I'm going to say, what light?
Yeah, maybe that's a good analogy.
Well, let's talk about our next research that matters that could be kind of news that, again, makes you feel good if you're not exercising and working out every day. Do you exercise and work out every day?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I do a lot of walking every day because of my job and so forth. But when we think about actually working out, where you can do kind of more aerobic physical activity designed to lower your heart rate, improve your cardiac performance, and so forth, not every day. And this is research that looks at, well, do you get benefits even if you're not doing it every day?
So, yes, they actually found out that you do. This was published in JAMA, Internal Medicine, with a group of British and Scottish adults that they found that those that what they called the weekend warriors, so those that worked out, you know, one or two, maybe three times a week as opposed to daily, had about a 30% lower mortality rate than those who didn't work out at all. And that was interesting because when they compared that to people that work out three or more times a week, the only difference was about 5%. So people that work out three or more times a week only had a 35% lower mortality rate.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So certainly more is better, but less is still good here. And that's certainly a lot better than none. And I think what this suggests is we need a certain amount of physical activity to really keep our cardiac condition intact. And there probably is a minimum amount. We are encouraging it. We're saying don't feel guilty if you're not doing it every day. Maybe you have a 15-month at home and you're working full-time as a doctor.
Does that relate to you at all? Just slightly.
Well, good research. We like it. Let's talk about our very last research that matters, about something that may be controversial. It may be something unknown to our listeners, but we think it's important.
We are talking about how we as doctors get paid.
Which we do get paid.
Sometimes we argue about how we get paid, and this, I guess, goes into that argument. I think the purpose of this article, which was in a journal of American Medical Association, kind of established a couple of different ways that physicians get paid. And the two most common types that you typically hear about when you hear about how doctors are paid is either salaried payment or fee-for-service payments. And you probably, Adam, would be able to more precisely describe these differences.
Yeah, so kind of in the good old days of the wild, wild west of medicine, a lot of doctors talk about this in, you know, the 1950s to, you know, the year 2000, doctors got paid fee for service. So the more you did, in some respects, the more money you made. The more patients you saw, the more money you made. That would be the fee for service. And the criticism of that is we would see too many patients and do too many procedures or things that might not be needed. Not ever you or I. And then this salary would be that you get a certain salary and it's not dependent upon how many people you see or what you order. You get the salary and you're trying to always do what's right for the patient and do not too much, not too little, just the right amount, as we would say in Goldilocks.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that some of the most famous healthcare systems use this straight salary basis. So places like Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, the Kaiser Group in California, all pay physician salaries without incentives for the volume of services that they perform.
And increasingly, healthcare systems are going to these mixed models where some could be for fee-for-service, some could be salary. Some of your salary could be at risk if you don't meet your quality metrics. If you can't really show that your diabetics are doing well, your hypertensives are doing well, that you've got people to quit smoking, lose weight. But if you do that, you may get more. Well, that is the kind of the win-win where we're trying to improve quality, reduce costs, improve the patient experience of care, and then we say the quadruple aim, improve the provider experience of care. I think we're moving more and more to this type of system away from the fee-for-service, but it's got a long way to go.
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, they had proven that the highest levels of job dissatisfaction were in part by the need to navigate these complexities of the fee-for-service arrangements. And so I think when we talk about the quadruple aim, that's an important part. You have to be happy to provide good care.
Yeah, I think you can always ask your provider, how does their income structured? And have that conversation. It's an okay conversation to have. I think our colleagues are really trying to do the best they can under sometimes very difficult circumstances, and that doesn't mean we can't do better. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. James Bolton, assistant professor at the University of Manitoba's Department of Psychiatry, about forgotten grievers, children who lose a brother or sister. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Wilson and Dr. Caroline Roberts. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Caroline Roberts. Today on Conversations, Caroline, we're talking with Dr. James Bolton, assistant professor at the University of Manitoba's Department of Psychiatry, about forgotten grievers, children who lose a brother or sister.
Welcome, Dr. Bolton. It's nice to have you on. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's very nice to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
You know, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in medicine and psychiatry.
Absolutely. So I'm a Canadian. I'm from a city called Winnipeg, which is in Manitoba, just north of Minnesota. And I've been interested in mental health for a long time. I'm actually the son of a psychiatrist. So I think that influenced me a little bit in my career path. But I've always been interested in people's stories, learning about people, hearing about their suffering and trying to find ways to help them. So that's really what led me into medicine. And then because I liked the interpersonal connection so much, I found that so rewarding and so valuable in medicine, that's why I continued on into psychiatry.
Wow. So how did you ever hear about stories about sibling loss and because as a psychiatrist, you form these really intense long-term relationships with patients. And so loss is part and parcel of all medicine, but it's probably even more intense in your field.
Certainly. That's exactly what I've experienced. Working in a long-term therapeutic context with patients, you get to hear about their stories. And although loss is something that happens to everybody, it is a very vulnerable time. And it affects people in different ways. And hearing people's stories about losing a brother or losing a sister, I could see how profoundly affected they were and often how that grief stayed with them for some time. So I was exposed to that not only in psychotherapy with patients, but also in my work in the emergency department. That's where I do a lot of work. And I would see people present in crisis after they had lost a brother or sister, and that's what started my interest in this area.
In reading your editorial and also reading the article by Dr. Yu in JAMA Pediatrics recently, it seemed like there is a fair amount of research on grieving parents who lose their children and also grieving children who lose their parents. But why do you think that information about grieving siblings has not been an area of research so far?
That's a very interesting question, Caroline, because certainly we do see that. As I started to get into the research side of things, there are a fair number of studies that do, as you say, look at the effects on parents who lose a child or vice versa. And I think that that's partly due to just people, I think, from any background can recognize the shock that would have on a parent to lose a child. That's something that's inherent in all of us. But often forgotten are siblings, and that's why they call them forgotten grievers. A lot of people are focusing on certain relationships, but they're neglecting to focus on the effects of the siblings. And we know that most children in the United States, most children in Canada do have siblings. So this is commonplace for a deceased person to have a sibling who then grieves their death.
You know, I'm thinking back to when my wife and I first came to North Carolina. And we were thinking about having a second child. And at the same time, my brother-in-law was dying of HIV disease at the time. And certainly after he passed, the tremendous amount of focus on my in-laws and their grieving. And I think I knew how much this affected my wife, but I don't think over longer periods of time, and now we've just observed probably the 22nd or 23rd memorial of his death. And What do we know about the incidents or the numbers of times? Because I imagine this is just as likely to happen as, of course, losing a child or a parent. I mean, this is exceedingly frequent.
Yes, it definitely is a very frequent event. And certainly we do see that very often in siblings. I mean, I think it's interesting to look at siblings. I hadn't thought about this before I got into this line of work, but a sibling relationship is the longest relationship that a person usually has in their life, longer than a relationship they'll have with a parent or their child, or longer than a spousal relationship. And I think that that's why, as you move through life, you continue to be reminded of that loss as you go through life. And to speak to how often this happens, in the United States, each year, 40,000 children and adolescents die. So that leaves a huge number of grieving siblings each year in the United States. So it's definitely something that's quite common.
One thing that shocked me is not only just how common this is, but also the physical risks that were studied that are affected by siblings that lose other siblings. And can you speak some to that?
Absolutely. It's an interesting observation, because it really speaks to the connection between the mind and the body. And as a psychiatrist working with patients, I see that all the time. I'm reminded of that. Somebody who's having an anxiety attack, and you see how their heart rate goes up or they have difficulty breathing. So I'm naturally a big believer in the mind-body connection. But studies like this really illustrate that point as well. The fact that the grieving sibling is actually quite vulnerable to experiencing a range of physical illnesses and actually, as the study by you and colleagues point out, death by physical causes. It's a very interesting observation indeed.
You know, one of the most tragic types of tragic deaths is someone who takes their own life. And I was shocked to see that is a major risk factor for these surviving siblings. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it can be surprising. It can be counterintuitive, but we do see that. And I've seen in the emergency department several patients who come in, and they tell us a story about how a close family member or a friend died by suicide. And they're coming in with their own suicide attempt, so just narrowly missing taking their own life. And it's quite a striking thing to observe and to be exposed to, because you think in some way that might be protective, but it isn't. It actually is a risk. And again, the study by you and colleagues showed that siblings who died by suicide, their surviving sibling had seven times the risk of dying by suicide themselves in the coming years, which is quite striking. The mechanism behind it, the explanation is people aren't sure about why that is. There's been lines of research that have certainly shown that suicide has a genetic or heritable component to it, the same way family members with schizophrenia, other family members are more likely to have schizophrenia, for example. Suicide can follow in families as well. But I think it also speaks to just the damaging social and environmental effect of losing somebody, that the distraught, the grief that the surviving sibling is left with, sometimes they may see no way out.
Wow.
So unfortunately, we need to take a quick break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. James Bolton, assistant professor at the University of Manitoba's Department of Psychiatry, about forgotten grievers, children who lose a brother or sister. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Caroline Roberts.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Caroline Roberts. We've been talking with Dr. James Bolton, assistant professor at the University of Manitoba's Department of Psychiatry, about forgotten grievers, children who lose a brother or sister. And one of the things I found, you know, surprising, Dr. Bolton, is the kind of the average age at which this the risk goes up. It seems to be earlier. I mean, I had a patient lose a sibling, and their birthdays, obviously, because it was a twin, was on the same day, and the patient died on the birthday. And so, I mean, all kinds of complexities there, that the birthday is the date of always grieving. But this was, of course, later in life. It seems like the risk is higher, or these things more so earlier. Why is that? What's that about?
Well, it's a very interesting thing to be aware of, very upsetting as well. Something we certainly have to be aware of as care providers. I think when the death is quite proximal, when it's recent, it's still very fresh, and we certainly see that with the people we treat. I've had several parents in my office who have lost a child to suicide, and that anniversary date in particular is such a difficult time, such a vulnerable time for becoming depressed or a range of mental health symptoms. So in this case that you described with a twin, losing their twin at the time of the birthday, that is just a very, very upsetting story, first of all. And something that the family members and the care providers need to take notice of it and be very aware for the ongoing anniversary dates in that twin's life. I think that that's one of the areas where, as the health profession, we don't have enough awareness about this effect on bereaved family members and siblings. And one of the reasons for that, again, in my experience clinically with working with families, is the care provider, the doctor, tends to be quite focused on the individual patient. And often before these people die, whether they have a physical illness that has led to their death or whether they've been struggling with mental health issues that then led to a suicide, they're under the care of a doctor who's very focused on them. And then when they die, there's a gap. There's a lack of awareness of the effects it might have on the family members, because the family members are not the patients in care. And that's where I think we need to do a better job moving forward as physicians. I think we need to be very aware of the effects of the family and have active outreach to them.
You know, I'm curious. I would love for you to give us advice that we can share with parents of children who pass away, because obviously they're not only parents to their child that they've lost, but to the sibling that remains. What do you tell parents how to best support the child that remains when they themselves are grieving?
That's a very important question, Caroline, and something that we need to do a lot of education with for parents. I think one of the things that people struggle with in general around death and bereavement is that nobody knows how to handle it. Nobody knows how to talk about it. And for me, one of the most difficult and best episodes of learning I ever did was actually outside of my usual medical practice. I went and sat in on a survivor group, a group of parents who had lost a child to suicide or another cause of death, and just listened to their stories. And what they talked about is the fact that people aren't aware. People don't talk about it. They ignore them because they don't know how to talk about this issue. So to get to your question, when we've got the parent in front of us asking us what to do, I think we just have to say, listen, you need to have a conversation. You need to be open about it. You need to recognize that everybody grieves death in different ways, but to not ignore it, to reach out and engage and talk about things in a very matter-of-fact way. That's much better than avoiding the problem and ignoring the person.
I wonder, is there a difference between those who perhaps lose a sibling due to a chronic illness and those who maybe lose a sibling due to pretty much trauma? And I'm thinking more about, all the siblings who were lost in 9/11, all the siblings who were lost in the wars in Syria, and these kind of, how does it differ in terms of what you need to do and what we need to do?
That's an interesting question. And it's something that's been debated in the bereavement research for some time. You know, is one cause of death, quote-unquote, worse than another cause? Does one have a more negative impact on the surviving family member? We did a very interesting study here in Canada, and we actually compared people, parents who had lost a child to suicide and parents who had lost a child in a motor vehicle collision. Both of these outcomes often happen to younger people. So we were able to look at the parents, and there was actually no differences. That was the takeaway from that study we did. And it was interesting to me because what it showed me was the importance of grief in general, that although there may be subtle differences, overall, losing a child, losing a sibling is a devastating experience for people, regardless of the cause. And that's a good reminder to surviving family members and to healthcare providers to say that we shouldn't judge or stigmatize the method that somebody died in. All of them are important, and all of these survivors need support.
How do you think moving forward? You kind of mentioned a little bit of research. What are the sorts of things that you think would really move us forward as providers, as society, culture, to help better understand, support, treat, prevent?
Yeah, I think there definitely is much we can do. I think overall just having awareness, really educating physicians and other care providers that this is a very real phenomenon, and so to look for it in clinical settings, to reach out and you know, connect with surviving family members and check in to see if they're okay. I think another step that we need to do is also to see what people's needs are. We really have no idea what the needs are of bereaved family members, and so to do surveys and other study methodologies to really determine what those needs are and determine what help people think they need and then how we can get them that help in a timely fashion.
You know, I'm thinking about another patient of mine who lost their sister recently and has a number of surviving sisters. The patient, a male patient, it seemed as if perhaps being the only male in the family, there were some unique aspects of a relationship, and there was the sister that they were closest to. And it seems like there's also this now we have to deal with what's that relationship like, which is very complex with all of the other sisters, and how to strengthen that. And I'm not sure where I would start when the counseling. How would you counsel that patient?
Well, the way I would start would be to again, try to connect with them, try to determine where they are, what they think they need, and to look at the details, as you say, of the relationships, really try to keep them connected in the therapeutic environment so that they feel that they are in a safe place where they feel heard and can actually talk about these things. We know that men and women often deal with mental health in different ways. Men are poor treatment seekers in general. You know, women are more likely to go and seek help for mental health reasons than men are. And some men turn towards drinking or other ways to try to address their symptoms. And so keeping all of these things at the forefront of our mind as we are being aware of the situation but applying it to the individual person sitting in front of us, I think will make us better physicians.
So, Dr. Bolton, if you could leave our listeners with one final thought about this topic, what would it be?
What I would say is that bereavement is a very important health problem. It is something that affects everyone. We need to be aware of it, and we need to try to get help for those people who have lost a sibling or other family member to death.
Well, we appreciate, Dr. James Bolton, your compassion, your empathy, your scientific mind, and your willingness to come on the air with your health listeners to talk about something that's going to happen to many, if not most people, at some point in time in their life.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you, Adam and Caroline, for your time and for giving me the chance to talk.
We've been talking with Dr. James Bolton, assistant professor at the University of Manitoba's Department of Psychiatry, about forgotten grievers, children who lose a brother or a sister. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Caroline Roberts. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Caroline, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address in an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today. Laura?
My daughter is 5 years old and wants to get her ears pierced. I'm okay with it, but my mother is strongly opposed. Is there anything wrong medically with letting her do it?
Well, you're going to get, I think, lots of opinions here.
Yes.
But maybe hard to know what it means if there's anything wrong. There are potential problems.
There's no guidelines, but there are recommendations. And so we'll share with you that the American Academy of Pediatrics actually recommends waiting until your child is old enough to be able to care for their ears themselves to prevent infection. And that's pretty intensive. It involves cleaning, putting on antibiotic cream. So there's a lot of stuff that a five-year-old might not be able to do.
In addition, there are potential risk of body piercing and using the types of jewelry that might go with them. One of them is people can be allergic to certain metals, and so a lot of the jewelry that people wear might have nickel, and so nickel dermatitis or inflammation can occur, and that's that infection point, Carolyn, that you were talking about. In addition to which, if you have any history of keloid or abnormal scar formation in the family, the child may be at risk, and those are really abnormal thickened scars that can come about as a result of any surgical procedure. And this is a surgical procedure, though it's a minor surgical procedure.
I think what it comes down to, it's a personal issue. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, but I do think it requires a lot of thought and a lot of consideration for everybody involved, and I think your child should be one of those people as well.
I think I probably would recommend waiting because I don't think the child at five can really do the care necessary. But on the other hand, I'm not getting in the middle of this conversation between the mother and the the grandmother. That one I'm not going to do.
You're a smart man, Adam Goldstein.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm 65, and I recently stepped awkwardly off of a curb and felt a pop in the back of my leg. I couldn't walk for 2 days, and my sister said I probably had pulled my hamstring. Also, it's been 3 days now, and I have a large bruise on the back of my leg. Do I need to see someone, or will this heal up on its own?
Ouch. That's the first thing I say. That, I suspect that was incredibly painful. Bad enough to causing a bruise, that's painful.
I would recommend being seen. It does not sound normal to me to not be able to walk for 2 days. That bruise sounds abnormal to me, and I would be worried a little bit about a potential tendon rupture or a potential tendon tear. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I agree. These are things that are kind of, it seems like intuitively obvious, but it's not intuitively easy. It seems like your diagnosis may be correct, but on the other hand, this is more complicated. These are sometimes serious injuries that can take prolonged periods of time to rehabilitate and may benefit from some therapy.
I would try at home what we kind of tell all of our patients with a potential pulled hamstring, RICE therapy. Rest it, ice it, compress it, elevate it. That'll give your doctor some information when you go in to see him or her, and that'll help prove if it's been a tear or a rupture or just a strain.
Yeah, the hamstring is such an important muscle, Caroline, involved in, as we know, in all kinds of walking, running activities, support, standing, all kinds of things. And, you know, it's hard to know, did this injury come about because you weren't ready? You missed that step. But there's lots of other things that I think a referral to a physical therapist particularly would be really useful to help you with your rehabilitation, whether it's the triper stretching exercises that you may need to do for a long period of time, the type of exercises to strengthen the muscle once you can start doing it. Because this can take, like we said, this could take months. Even in an elite athlete, you're talking about at least 6 weeks, sometimes, again, 3 months. And these are the high-end elite athletes, football, basketball, and so forth. In this particular situation, you know, I don't think surgery would be indicated, but, you know, the sooner you can start therapy, including maybe even a hot tub or other sort of therapies that help heal.
Hot tub therapy sounds nice.
It wouldn't hurt any of us, would it?
No.
No. And I think the other final thing is if you don't get the right therapy, the possibility of having something else happening, you know, we don't think you probably need x-rays, but in some circumstances you might, you know, could you have done something else here that may have not just been the pulled muscle, but something a little more serious? So again, we both agree going in to see your primary care physician would be a good thing. What's our very next house call, Laura?
I've had lower back pain on and off for a couple of years, and I was told that I had some early arthritis in my back. Over the last 3 months, I've had pain in my hip that goes to my groin. I've seen doctors who've done an injection and given me medicines, neither of which helped. Could this be related to the arthritis?
Well, the answer is it could.
Anything.
Well, that's why, you know, that's not a really helpful comment.
No.
It's not even
helpful.
First off, we're sorry that you're having pain. And we're sorry that you've been to the doctor several times and it hasn't seemed to get better. Both of those things are things that are concerning for us.
You know, any time that I hear somebody who has a history of arthritis, who then has worsening or new or changed pain, makes me think that we need to look deeper, that we're missing something when we call it just arthritis. Common stuff for people that have arthritis in their back, it could potentially lead to a slipped or a compressed disc, which I worry about in your case because the pain is now being referred somewhere. Makes me think of a nerve compression.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times common things happen commonly. You've been treated for some of the common things, and it doesn't seem to be improving. So uncommon things can happen. And even though a disc is somewhat uncommon, it certainly happens. We see it a lot. And sometimes we miss it, in which case it is not getting better here. And so diagnosing it may be important because then you might need to get the right therapy, whether it's a different form of physical therapy, whether it's an injection, or in some cases, unfortunately, yeah, surgery, because if it's not getting better, if you're getting more weakness, pain, that may be one of the few things that can actually help. So I think pushing like you're doing is the right thing.
Right. I think any pain that is new or changed should be your body's sign that you should get it checked out a little bit further.
What's our very last house call, Laura?
I'm a 70-year-old woman who had a stroke last year that resulted in weakness in my left arm and leg. I'm having physical therapy to get stronger, but my physical therapist has recently noticed I've been falling more and wonders if I need to get checked for a urinary tract infection. What do you think?
Well, this is a complicated question, and I'd be curious, Caroline, what you think, because, you know, someone who's having falls, who's had a stroke, boy, you got to think about a lot of different things, including possibly an infection.
Yeah. I would like to ask you more questions about your falls because there's a lot of different reasons that you could be falling. It could be, you know, anytime that somebody's had a stroke, we put them on new medicines to perhaps control their blood pressure better. That could be a reason you're falling. We put them on different medicines to help prevent other things, and that could also be contributing to your falls. But infection, whether it be a urinary tract infection or a pneumonia or simply just the common cold, could unmask weakness. It can make you feel more weak and kind of unmask those deficits left over from your previous stroke. You may even notice that when you're tired or you're more fatigued that you're easier to fall just because you're not as strong and you can't protect those muscles as well.
We also worry about, you know, could you have had another stroke and certainly causing the original and a second stroke, and that might even change the treatment. So this is one of the circumstances where you really do need to get in to see your doctor, whether it's your primary care doctor or neurologist or physical medicine and rehab specialist, and decide whether or not you actually have to have another workup done, as well as, you know, look at all the medicines. I mean, some of the medicines that you may be taking could make your muscles weaker. I'm thinking of one in particular that sometimes we give to people after stroke called gabapentin. Sometimes that has some, or even a muscle relaxer, could actually have an adverse effect. So I would look at medication side effects too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, we love our colleagues that help us out. And so I think if your physical therapist is concerned, then we are as well.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today. We hope we've answered questions that are important to you and your health. You can send your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. Search Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, co-host Dr. Caroline Roberts, and our guest today, Dr. James Bolton. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Caroline Roberts.
And we'll see you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.